Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
What's this? A worker-friendly decision from the National Labor Relations Board? Meanwhile, streetcar employees organize in Oklahoma, a right-to-work state, drive through to beat the flu. How about that? And today on the show, the latest from the nation, the North American building trades, and what the pandemic has done to one urban school district. Good afternoon and welcome to the Thursday, October 15th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, as well as Spotify. Also on Facebook, AWF Union Podcast. We have actually three guests on the show today. John Nichols, one of the great writers of The Nation magazine, will be our first guest. TheNation.com for more information. He is their national affairs correspondent. And today he's going to talk about the confirmation hearings for Amy Coney Barrett, which probably are wrapping up today with the Senate Judiciary Committee, and then it'll go for a full vote. John is of the opinion that Supreme Court justices are not answerable to the people of the United States. They are nominated by partisan executives, confirmed by partisan legislators. Justices joined a largely unaccountable third branch of the federal government that has in the past seized opportunities to overturn popular legislation enacted to protect voting rights, women's rights, and so on. He says it is the anti-democratic reality of the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, keep in mind, judges are in there on the federal level for life. And John talked to Ro Khanna, lawmaker out of California, about this. And Ro believes it's time to establish term limits for Supreme Court justices. He's figuring 18 years. 18 years and you're done. And it's a real simple process. Create a regular appointment process to allow every president to nominate a new justice to the Supreme Court during each odd year, guaranteeing each president the opportunity to nominate two justices per four-year term. And permit justices who have served their 18-year terms to continue their service on lower courts. Kind of like a revolving door. Interesting idea. Does it have legs? Well, I think we need a change in leadership in the government to move forward on something like that. So John Nichols will be our first guest. Tom Krieger will be joining us on behalf of the North American Building Trades Union. And he's going to talk about recruiting women in the trades through apprenticeship readiness programs. As you know, we've been promoting the fact that this Saturday is Trade Women's Build Nations Day, a virtual conference this year because of the pandemic. And the whole idea is to attract, especially now with so many people unemployed, get more women in the trades. Diversity awareness, sexual harassment prevention are mandatory subjects, by the way, in NABTU's apprenticeship readiness program curriculum. And some states apparently have moved forward with this. Four of them, Oregon, Minnesota, Maine, and Washington, have made significant strides in recruiting and, more importantly, retaining female apprentices. A lot of times they start it and they say, oh, I don't know if this is for me. So Tom will be our second guest. Eric Gordon, who is the superintendent of the Cleveland Metropolitan School District, will be our third guest, and he's filling in for Pat Gallagher. Pat Gallagher, of course, with the North Coast Labor Federation and the steelworkers, decided to turn it over to him because the Cleveland school system, much like many urban school districts, is in financial trouble. They've been in financial trouble for many years. The pandemic has just complicated things. How about this? According to Cleveland officials, the district spent nearly $23 million on expenses related to the pandemic. That includes More than $17 million spent on technology. You take a look at rich districts versus poor districts. You've often heard about the digital divide. And in the poorer districts, the students just don't have the tools. They don't have the computers. And you need a computer in today's world. So the pandemic has kind of cast a light on this. And Eric Gordon is going to talk about the need to raise more money for the Cleveland schools. And they're not alone. Like I said, they're one of many urban districts in financial trouble in 2020. So he'll be our third guest right here on America's Workforce. Well, it's not too often you get a positive ruling from the National Labor Relations Board. Apparently, this week, they issued a complaint against HCL America, which is a Google contractor. Why? Violating labor rights. Yeah. According to the complaint, HCL illegally discouraged workers from belonging to a union and failed to bargain with the union in good faith. The complaint alleged that managers at HCL interrogated workers about their colleagues' organizing activities and told workers that promotions and wages would be delayed because of the union campaign. The company also began shifting some work overseas to Poland. HCL employees who perform work, including data analysis under contracts HCL has with Google, voted unionized last fall. And according to the New York Times, while some blue-collar workers in the tech industry have formed unions, the HCL union was believed to be the first group of white-collar tech employees to organize while working for a major company. So that struggle there, at least for now, is going in the right direction for the workers. How about this? Princeton University has agreed to pay nearly $1 million in back pay to female professors following an investigation into alleged pay discrimination. The agreement resolves a multi-year investigation brought by the Department of Labor's Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs. That investigation involved more than 100 female full professors and spanned the years 2012 to 2014. Princeton made the agreement to pay back pay and future pay without admitting liability, claiming the university officials did an internal analysis and found no meaningful pay disparities based on gender. Well, despite that being said, Princeton will pay $925,000 in back pay and $250,000 in future wages. Streetcar workers in Oklahoma City have joined together and are using their collective voice to demand increased safety protections on the job. With COVID-19 cases reaching record highs in Oklahoma and increasing across many states in the country, these public transportation workers are taking action to protect themselves and their passengers by joining the Amalgamated Transit Union. This is Local 993. The new union members have said that Herzog Transit Services, Inc., the company in charge of managing Oklahoma City's streetcar system, is failing to provide workers with timely notification when their colleagues become infected, and they're retaliating against them for speaking up about their safety concerns. Chris Bork is the president of Local 993. He said Herzog's lack of regard for our members' health and safety is shameful and not a reflection of the values we expect moving forward. So the workers voted overwhelmingly to have a union. And keep in mind, Oklahoma is a right-to-work state. One more here. The Hawaii State AFL-CIO's Labor Community Services Program partnered with My Health Solutions in anticipation of an active flu season on top of the pandemic. So to combat what they call the twindemic of COVID-19 and influenza, they set up a drive-through flu vaccination clinic called Drive Through to Beat the Flu. It was held in Honolulu last weekend. Got a quote here. Our clinic was available to everyone with or without insurance. So many of our people have either been furloughed or have lost their jobs and their health insurance due to COVID-19. We know a healthier community is a way to get people back to work and create more stability in our lives. Hats off to the Hawaii State AFL-CIO. You know, their union density in Hawaii is like 23%. Contrast that with, I think, what is it, South Carolina at 2%. You got good union density, good things happen. All right, we have to take a break. You're listening to America's Workforce, our segment with The Nation Magazine coming up next. Don't go away.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output. A half million strong. We're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
America's Workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And welcome back to America's Workforce. Don't forget we're available on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, also on Facebook, AWF Union Podcast, and that is our Twitter handle, at AWF Union Podcast. This is our segment with The Nation Magazine. We do this each and every month, and joining us on line number one is John Nichols. John is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation, also the author of several books, his latest being The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. I believe we talked about that extensively in our last show. Today, we're talking about the story of the last couple of weeks, and that is the Supreme Court and the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to fill the seat of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. John, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us once again here on America's Workforce.
It's great to be with you, my friend.
Well, you, in your latest posting, talk about possible term limits for the justices. Mm-hmm. I want to get into that. I think it's a great idea, and apparently one of the lawmakers out of California has come up with this. A lot of people don't realize that these are, and when it comes to federal judges, they're lifetime appointments. And in this case, Amy Coney Barrett is in her 40s. She could be there for a long, long time, 40, maybe 50 years, who knows. But let me ask you, I know you've been monitoring this. It seems to be going at lightning speed. What's your thoughts on this? On this whole nomination process? Go ahead, John.
Well, I appreciate it. And look, you're right. Lightning speed is the exact term for it. And we're talking about someone who will have immense power to define our lives for generations. To give you an example, Oliver Wendell Holmes served on the U.S. Supreme Court until he was 90 years old. If Amy Coney Barrett serves on the Supreme Court until she's 90, that'll be 2062. And
oh boy,
that means she'll serve through 10 presidential elections. So, you know, you'd think if you're picking somebody who's going to serve through 10 presidential elections, you know, until your grandchildren are getting older, that you ought to pause a little bit and kind of really, you know, have genuine advice and consent. That was the concept that the founders came up with, right? That president could nominate, the Senate's supposed to advise and consent. They don't give their consent until they've, you know, thoroughly examined it. Well, that's not happening. We're racing through this process, and huge issues are getting scant attention. I'll give you an example. Today, Sheldon Whitehouse, the senator from Rhode Island, brought up labor rights. And it was a really, really important dialogue. He was talking about the Janus decision, and he was talking about the Knox decision from back a number of years ago, various other decisions that have come down the pike. And he was essentially saying, look, there's a really strong indication that Samuel Alito, one of the, you know, associate justices on this court, is hell-bent to use this court to eliminate labor rights, to literally and fundamentally undermine the right to organize, the right to collectively bargain, you know, all the structures that we have in place. And so the senator wanted Amy Coney Barrett to discuss some of her views as regards established law and, you know, the standards and the approaches to these things. Well, he got her to say a couple things. Of course, she avoided answering, which is, you know, the big reality of the whole deal. But instead of, you know, going deep on that and getting everything sorted out, at least getting her on the record as best you can, you know, that was a couple minutes, right? And then they're on to the next thing, voting rights, the ACA, which they have discussed a lot. Women's rights, gay rights, you know, all of these issues. But, you know, think about this. Somebody is going to serve on the Supreme Court for 50-some years, maybe, literally define our work life going forward, and we get maybe, what, 4 or 5 minutes to discuss the whole of workplace law, the whole of, you know, laws as regards relationships between workers and their employers, the whole of law as regards whether you can have a union or not. That's ridiculous. That is not, that's not advice and consent. That's just racing through the process.
Yeah, yeah. It's so unfortunate. And I'll say one thing that Trump has done a good job at, and that is unwinding everything that Obama did, unwinding his legacy. I mean, look, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act. That could be gone under a 6-3 majority on the Supreme Court. You talk about labor law. Look what he did to the NLRB. It's really sad. It's really sad in the direction that he has gone here in the almost 4 years that he's been in the White House. Here's the thing that really troubles me, John. The other day, Dianne Feinstein asked her, and she's supposed to be a pretty bright woman, Amy Coney Barrett, and she asked her if the Constitution gave Trump the right to delay the election. And she was very wishy-washy on her answer. And she said she'd had to hear arguments from the litigants, and she should know that according to the Constitution, only Congress can delay or change the date of an election.
Right.
I mean, why couldn't she just say that? But she didn't.
Well, that's... You damn right, brother. That was a scary moment in that, and it wasn't the only scary moment, but it was one that stood out to me. In fact, it's funny you bring it up because I was literally, as I talked to you, I was taking a break from writing about that exact issue because you're right that the Congress, the only force that can actually change, the only part of government that can actually change the date, and we should understand the reason for that. The Constitution gives that power to the Congress. And we should also understand that there's a reason why in these times the date for the election has been set in November, because you have a calendar. It's just like any of us in our lives. You have a calendar. You kind of work back from a certain thing that you know you got to get done, so you start to put stuff in place. If you're a construction worker, right, you know you got to get the project done by December 1, so you look back on your schedule. How do you, you know, have your workers in the right place? How do you begin the work at the right time, et cetera? Well, it's the same for an election. We know the date where everything has to be settled and in place. That's, you know, on January 20th. Of 2021, we got to have a selection out of this. So then you got to take your steps back in the process. You go back to when the Senate reviews the Electoral College votes, when the Electoral College actually does vote, when you have the results and when you review them. You know, it's date. And so this is both a practical and a structural reality. It is not something you can mess with. Amy Coney Barrett should know that. Again, both from a practical and a structural standpoint. She should understand that there are laws on the books that set the dates for when we have the election and also set the dates for when the Electoral College meets and all of the steps after that. She should also know that if you mess with that, you're literally messing with the basic premises of the Constitution. Instead of just saying that, and she could say it much easier than I, she'd just say, yep, there's election law that's in place, and there's a Constitution that underpins that election law. And I will abide by that. I will respect that, of course. She never said it. She refused to say that. And the interesting thing was that Dianne Feinstein brought that up on Tuesday, and it was such a shocking statement that then on Wednesday, Dick Durbin brought it up, literally read the testimony back to Amy Coney Barrett, and he said, you know, boy, do you want to revisit this? Do you want to clarify a little bit here?
Yeah.
She stood by her statement, and she absolutely said she wouldn't engage in legal hypotheticals. Well, this isn't a legal hypothetical. It's not a legal hypothetical like some theory you're fooling around with. It's the law. And she also said in another comment that she didn't want to be a legal pundit. Well, she's not being a legal pundit if she is saying, yes, I intend to abide by the law. If anyone tries to delay the election, I will, as a judge, know what the laws are, know what the constitutional premises that underpin them are, and I will apply them.
Very upsetting.
You got that said, you're done.
Yeah. Yeah.
She didn't do it. She absolutely refused not once but twice to do it.
Let's talk about your latest article, Term Limits for the Supreme Court. I think it's a great idea, and apparently this is the idea of, what is it, Ro Khanna, who is a legislator, lawmaker out of California. What is it, 18 years he's looking at something like this? And let's talk about some of the specifics here and how this would be executed and what needs to be done to make this happen. What's your thoughts on all this?
Well, first, let's start with the fact that it can be done. And that's always a big deal, because a lot of people have ideas for reforms and they sound great, but then they say, yeah, well, by the way, we'd have to amend the Constitution or something like that.
Right.
You don't have to amend the Constitution to do this. The Constitution says, basically, it was actually remarkably vague as regards to the judiciary, but it says that presidents nominate, the Senate gives advice and consent. It never, ever says that they have life tenure. The concept of life tenure, the concept that you, once you're on there, you get to serve forever, that's not in the Constitution. It just says they serve on good behavior. Right. And that was over time interpreted to mean that they could serve until they behave badly or something like that. But it's not in there. There's no set rule. In fact, the idea of life tenure was actually only laid down in 1869 in a judicial act done, years after the Constitution. And it was done by Congress, not by the framers of the Constitution. So Congress has the ability to say that there's a certain amount of time you serve. House and Senate can do that. President would have to sign it. And you'd have to probably have a different Senate and a different president, but it's certainly within the realm of possibility. And so what Ro Khanna is saying is that each new justice that's appointed to the court can serve for 18 years. Once they're approved, they go on. They served their 18 years. As an example, if Amy Coney Barrett was coming along under this system and she got approved, she could serve till 2038. That's a really long time from now, but it's not 2062.
Right.
And so, there is a limit. Now, he also says that those who are on the court, say you appoint a young person to the court, they serve their 18 years. You don't really want them necessarily to go back into the workplace, trying to get, build up some big legal clientele. So they can continue to serve on lower court benches. So a former Supreme Court justice who's done their 18 years would go down and serve on the appellate court or maybe on a federal court bench if they so choose. And so there's a system for continuity there. It's all very logical. And then here's the most compelling part of it. Because of this cycle, because you got nine justices serving 18 years, what it means is that every couple of years, you have an opening come. So down the line, once this has been done, once you've got this process in place, every president should have the ability to fill a couple of places on the court. It would happen every couple of years that an opening would come. It would just be cyclical. But you would remove the two of the more kind of awful parts of the current process. Number one, kind of like this calculating, you know, when somebody might quit the court in order to give a political ally an opportunity to appoint a successor. And that you've seen that with several judges in history, or just that awful situation of waiting for when a justice might become incapacitated or die. And you move beyond that. And of course, there might be cases where justices do become incapacitated or whatever, but much more likely they leave on a set schedule. And because of that set schedule, it takes a lot of the pressure, a lot of the burden off the confirmation process. You don't have these sort of like, you know, kind of overwhelming moments in our history, which we happen to be in one of now. And it also, last thing, is it takes the burden off an individual judge, right? You know, you know that somebody new is coming on in 2 years. And so to a much greater extent, you can, you can serve your tenure not as the person who might flip control of the court. It's possible that an appointment might do so, but you know that another appointment's coming 2 years later, right?
So
much of what's amiss, so much of what doesn't work in the current process could be fixed with this simple reform that's been proposed by Ro Khanna, that is backed by a number of very prominent law professors. And in fact, interestingly enough, let me tell you about somebody who actually entertained the notion of term limits for judges. A young lawyer who was an assistant White House counsel under Ronald Reagan back in the early 1980s wrote a memo talking about the potential value of having a 15-year term limit, a little bit less, and saying that you'd refresh the court on a regular basis. It would keep justices in touch with the world. They wouldn't be just in the ivory tower for decade after decade. Kind of some positive thoughts on it. That young lawyer was John Roberts.
Oh, my gosh. How about that? Oh,
he may have changed his opinion.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now that he's Chief Justice, hey, I got this for life, buddy. What an amazing
story.
He
wrote a memo laying the whole thing out. And obviously, Ro Khanna, among others, cites that in making his argument.
Oh, John, you're great. I so appreciate your commentary here on America's Workforce. I wish we had some more time. We're going to have to set up maybe in the next couple of months. I'm sure we'll have a lot to dissect after this election. And hopefully, if we get the right people in place, and you alluded to this, if we get the right people in place, maybe we could go in that direction on the 18-year term limits for the Supreme Court. So you take care, be safe, and I promise to keep in touch. Okay, John?
I sure appreciate it, brother. It's great talking to you.
John Nichols, National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation magazine. You can find more at thenation.com. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Tom Krieger will be joining us on behalf of the North American Building Trades Union. And don't forget, you're listening to America's Workforce. Back in a few.
This is America's Workforce.
Hire union musicians. Call Music Talent of Cleveland at 216-881-1802. Call Music Talent of Cleveland as your dependable source for professional musicians in Northeast Ohio. Union musicians add harmony to weddings, elegance to parties, and uplifting music for all events. Music Talent of Cleveland contracts solo and ensemble musicians as well as bands and orchestras for single engagements. So hire union musicians. Call Music Talent of Cleveland today. 216-881-1802.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our Raising Wages agenda, go to aflcio.org.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialists, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
Hey, we're back. It's America's Workforce. And don't forget, we're available on various platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, as well as Spotify. And when you get a chance, just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. We would appreciate a 5-star rating. Let's go to line number 2 right now and welcome back to the show. It's been a while. We've had him on. Tom Krieger is his name. And we had him on some years back when he was with the National Labor College. Now he's with North America's Building Trades Union, or better known as NABTU. He's the Director of Research and Education. Tom, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us here on America's Workforce.
Hey, Ed. Thanks. Great to be here.
How long have you been with the with NABTU now?
I've been with the Building Trades about 8 years.
Okay. Okay, and all that time, the Director of Research and Education, I take it?
Yes, yes. I've been involved with education all my life, and it's a great privilege for me to work with the building trades, because one of my responsibilities there is to help recruit women, people of color, and veterans into the construction industry. So I'm really glad that you're talking about Women Build Nations today, tradeswomen build nations. That's one of my favorite subjects.
Yeah, we've been doing a lot on it, and unfortunately, this has to go online because of the pandemic, but it seems that everybody is on board. I didn't realize until I started delving into this how large this conference is. I mean, it attracts people, especially now with the pandemic and being virtual, people from around the world. So that's a good thing. Are you involved in the setup of that? Will you be speaking? Let's start right there. What's your role for this Saturday's conference?
I have been, in the past, I have been involved with the setup of the conference. You know, with the pandemic and having a virtual conference this year, I've had less of a role, but I really look forward to it. I mean, I have attended these conferences in the past, and the energy and the, you know, just the spirit of this conference, the women have when they do the in-person meeting, they have a banner parade. And that's one of the great things I've ever seen in life, that, you know, they get to show their attachment to their union. And the last time I was at the conference, it was in Seattle. And I stood on a sidewalk in Seattle, and that parade was probably 30, 40 minutes long of, you know, just women, you know, proudly marching with their union banners right down, I think it was Pike Street or Pike Place in Seattle.
That's great. You think because of, I guess, the pandemic is one thing, and the fact that there's so many people out of work right now, this seems to be an opportune time for women and men. I mean, I don't want to exclude men to get involved in the trades. And obviously, since they're deemed essential workers, they stayed working when a lot of states were shut down. This would be an opportune time. Maybe, you know, with that being said, what's your opinion moving forward on this?
Well, I think you hit it right on the head. It's a great opportunity for women. I mean, we do a lot of recruiting around the country. My own personal, you know, sort of little window on this is I am the administrator of a national curriculum that the building trades developed about 12 years ago to specifically recruit more women, people of color, and veterans into the industry. It's called the Multi-Craft Core Curriculum. And just to give you an example of how this has grown, when I started with the building trades in about 2012, there was maybe 15 or 20 of these programs around the country. The program started in 2009. Today we have 170 different schools, or, you know, places. Sometimes it's in the public school, sometimes it's in the building trades training centers, community colleges. The 170 schools that teach this curriculum. And just to give you a sense of, you know, the number of women that have gone through over the last 3 years, we've had about 7,000 people nationally complete this curriculum. And when just a little bit on the curriculum itself, the MC3, as we call it, the Multicraft Core Curriculum, prepares women for the aptitude test. And it's, there's a lot of math in there because that's, you know, the construction is a math-heavy occupation. They're going to be doing math every day. And the goal of this curriculum is to prepare people for to do the interviews and also the aptitude test. So out of that 7,000 women that have completed, or 7,000 people that have completed, 1,200 of them have been women. And that we've so far placed about 500 of those women into, you know, full-time apprenticeship positions in the building trade. Those are good jobs, you know, as you know well. Those are good pay, benefits, and, you know, lots of opportunities for advancement.
Is it across the board when it comes to the trades, carpenters, electricians, plumbers? Is there one that's probably more in demand than the other right now? What's your thoughts?
We place, you know, people, young people and some not so young people and women included in all of the trades. That's the great thing about the Multicraft Core Curriculum. It teaches people about the construction industry. It teaches them about the trades. So they can make an informed choice when they, you know, when they choose what apprenticeship program to go into. And there's a pretty good body of evidence that's growing that says if someone goes through one of these pre-apprenticeship programs, we call them apprenticeship readiness, because you still have to meet the obligations of the, you know, the particular trade. But if you go through one of those programs, the retention rate goes up for women. And that means that, you know, they stick, they stay in the industry. Yeah. And that's better for return on investment for the both the contractors and the unions.
Absolutely. Talk to me about the diversity awareness, sexual harassment prevention, because as you know, Tom, back in the 70s and 80s, it was all guys, and it had to be rough. In fact, we've had several guests here in the last week and a half talking about the culture change. Wow, what, you know, why don't you stay home and raise your kids? You know, that kind of attitude. And, you know, again, times have changed. I'm just wondering, is this something that's taught today as far as how to adapt to the to a more male environment?
Oh, it absolutely is. I mean, the MC3, our curriculum, just to give you one example, was developed by our apprenticeship and training committee. But we also work very closely with the same committee that puts on Tradeswomen Build Nation. It's the Tradeswomen Committee, the NAB2 Tradeswomen Committee. And they jointly developed a mandatory section of this apprenticeship readiness training, and has two parts. And the first part is diversity awareness, because, you know, men and women are going to be supervising men and women as they become foremen, as they become supervisors on the job, as they become apprenticeship instructors. So you have to learn how to deal with a very diverse range of people in the trades today, because we really welcome everybody in the trades today. That's, you know, we see diversity as a great strength in the building trades today. So that translated into a piece of the curriculum to teach about that. So, you know, language is important. You know, we don't say foreman. I just use that term. We sometimes say forepersons, or, you know, journey level workers instead of journeymen, to be more welcoming to women. And then the other part is that what you got back to, and I think you hit it right on the head. I mean, the contemporary building trades were built by my father's generation. I mean, my family didn't come out of the trades. My father was an apprentice, but he wasn't in the trades. He came back from World War II and did an apprenticeship. And that happened to a lot of men who came back from World War II, and they really built that, you know, they built the contemporary building trades, and they built it on very structured, as you know, gender roles. And you know, today that's really, really changed. So we stress, and it's required that you do sexual harassment prevention training in the MC3. So everybody that comes through our pre-apprenticeship training understands that, you know, diversity is important. It's important that you learn how to relate to and understand and really celebrate, you know, a wide collection of people in the building trades today. And also that we just don't tolerate some of that old behavior, the sexual harassment behavior that was kind of endemic to the industry. I think you're right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the Me Too movement has changed a lot of the dynamics in so many occupations, even beyond the trade. So, like I said, times are changing, and it's good. It's good that you're putting so much thought and preparedness into this, because it's so much needed. Talk to me on the state level. Maybe you can compare it with the federal level. I'm just wondering,
the differences here, and I understand there's several states, I believe four of them in particular, is it Washington, Maine, Minnesota, and Oregon, have made very significant strides in recruiting and, more importantly, retaining female apprentices. What details can you give us on that, Tom?
You're right. I mean, overall, women are about 4% of craft workers. They're about 9% of all construction workers. So that includes engineers and you know, folks that the front office people and architects and that. But among craft workers, our numbers are still low. But there are a number of states that have shown that you can recruit women and get them to stay in the trades. And those are the states you mentioned. Massachusetts is another one. We have a number of women's groups around the country in those states. Oregon Tradeswomen, in Seattle, the non-traditional employment for women in New York City. So there's a number of places where, you know, women have really contributed to that conversation. One of the things they've contributed is mentoring. And I'll give a shout out to my colleague, Doreen Cannon. Doreen's the president of in Cleveland of UA Local 55. She's also an apprenticeship instructor. And she went a couple of years ago to Dave Wondolowski. Dave Wondolowski's head of the Cleveland Building Trades. And she made a good argument that you need a tradeswomen committee in Cleveland to mentor young apprentices, because it's one thing for us nationally and for folks in Cleveland to recruit women in the trades. But, you know, as you said, when they get on the job, they, you know, they may be treated roughly, and there still may be some, you know, some cultural laggers out there who don't appreciate that, you know, women make up an important part of our industry. So they set up the support process in Cleveland, and that's, we consider that a national model, that what Doreen Cannon and Dave Wondolowski have done there to provide support for young women on the job, place where apprentices can go maybe at a happy hour and talk to journey level workers and, you know, to hear their coping skills and coping mechanisms and things. Because, you know, again, I just have to stress, this is a really good job, and there are really, really great opportunities for women out there. There was a study that I, you know, I'm the research guy, I track in numbers. There's this group called Smart Asset, and they came out just a couple of weeks ago, October 2nd, with a study of the fastest growing parts of the construction industry. And the construction laborers was up over the last 3 years, 64% just among women. Construction painters was up the same thing, over 50% job increase. And the average salary, $68,000, and, you know, that's probably even a little low with overtime and that, you know, in this economy, it's the construction economy has been very good. And these are jobs where women can support their families on their own. They can plan for their futures. You know, that's the, you know, the sky's the limit once you get into the building trades these days.
Yeah, and going back to what we first talked about with the pandemic, how many jobs were lost in leisure, hospitality, restaurants? I mean, a lot of restaurants aren't coming back. And many of those jobs, retail is another one, they're not coming back. They're not coming back. And they did not come near the wages that you would make in the trades. So, again, perfect opportunity right now. It's funny you bring up Doreen Cannon. We're going to have her on the show tomorrow. And we have we had Dave Wondolowski on yesterday talking about what you just said. He was really proud of what Doreen put together there. And, yeah she's a fighter. She's a fighter and a forward thinker. All good stuff. I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but, you know, both of them, they have put some resources into this. I would urge your listeners, you know, just go to your search engine and type in Cleveland Building Trades. And on the Cleveland Building Trades Council website, they've got videos on diversity in construction, which we use in the MC3. They're so good. And it really tells the story, you know, that they really do value diversity and the role of women and people of color in Cleveland. And they celebrate the fact that, you know, that they bring people in from every neighborhood in Cleveland, and that the building trades workforce really has to look like and model the Cleveland workforce. And, you know, that's where you get community buy-in. That's where we're going to get more projects and things and more support for our work.
Cleveland, Ohio, leading the way. Well, born and raised here in Cleveland, Ohio, home of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We appreciate what you just said here. So that's good. Moving forward. By the way, I record the show at Local 17 of the Iron Workers. So it's all union, all good. And it's happening right here in Cleveland, Ohio. Tom, you take care. Keep up the great work you're doing on behalf of the North American Building Trades. And for more information on that Trade Women Build Nations conference, go to NABTU or NAB2.org/TWBN. You take care and keep in touch with us, all right?
All right, Dad. Thanks anytime.
All right. We're going to take a quick break when we come back. Eric Gordon, Superintendent, CEO of the Cleveland Metropolitan School District, right here on America's Workforce. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest-growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output, a half million strong. We're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
You're listening to America's Workforce, and this next segment brought to you by the North Coast Labor Federation.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And welcome back to America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, also on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter, Twitter handle at AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to line number three. Welcome to the show, Eric Gordon. Mr. Gordon is the CEO, superintendent of the Cleveland Metropolitan School District, and he's here to talk about the financial impact of the pandemic on Cleveland schools, and it's astronomical. Mr. Gordon, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me today.
So I'm reading, what is it, close to what, $23 million in expenses related to the pandemic? That's a lot of money that you didn't have in the budget now, did you?
Yeah, that's a big expense that we didn't plan for. But, you know, the pandemic has required new things from us. We have bought thousands of iPads, laptops, tablets, hotspots for internet connectivity. We've bought, lots and lots of PPE, so sanitation materials and equipment, signage, and those sorts of things. And we've continued to feed our kids and families breakfast and lunch throughout the spring, summer, and fall. And we're not getting the full reimbursement we would normally get from the federal government because the meal counts are down. And so keeping our workforce in place has added to those expenses as well.
Now, did you get money from the CARES Act that was passed in March? Did that some money filter into your school system?
Yeah, we received about $27 million in the CARES Act. That is spent. We anticipate probably another $20 million in additional expenses yet this year in more hotspots, more cleaning and disinfecting materials, more resources in transportation and operations, and then also in the instructional software that we've purchased for our kids. So the CARES Act was certainly helpful, but I've been a big advocate that we need another stimulus and stabilization package for schools, municipalities, and states who particularly got very little in the packages we've seen so far.
Now, you have an issue on the upcoming ballot here, issue 68, that's going to ask homeowners to cough up some more money. And I know this is a difficult issue to come forward. If it does not pass for you, what's going to happen to the school system?
Well, we've been very careful not to threaten or scare our community, but if it doesn't pass, it's 12% of our net operating budget that would essentially end in December. And that means we would have to make very, very deep cuts. 20 to 25 school buildings would close. 15% of our workforce at all levels of the organization would have to be laid off. And we would make deep cuts in things like early childhood, sports, extracurricular programs, student transportation, and things like that. Our goal, of course, is to pass it. And so we're out working hard to make sure that none of that becomes a reality.
Yeah, this has got to be a tough sell here for so many people. You know, the bigger picture here, and you know this, over the years, a lot of companies have moved out and the tax base has shrunk dramatically. And when new businesses come in, what do they ask for? They ask for like a tax incentive, or some kind of a rollback so they don't have to pay taxes. One case in point, I mean, I'm sure you're familiar with Amazon. Their distribution centers, they do that. We have Sherwin-Williams, a Cleveland company that goes back to the Civil War. They're building a new headquarters. Wasn't there a tug of war going on? Maybe you could speak to that issue and how that affects systems like Cleveland.
Well, that is a very typical experience, particularly for cities and then suburbs who entice businesses by giving tax breaks. I will say that our city and Mayor Jackson here in Cleveland has been very careful to only do tax breaks that are school friendly and hold the school district harmless. And for Sherwin-Williams in particular, they actually made a point to make sure that schools weren't harmed. This is a community that cares about their kids, and even the business community has shown that good faith in many, many ways.
Now, how long have you been superintendent, Eric?
I'm in my 10th year as superintendent, my 14th year in the district.
Okay. And I've noticed some strides. The needle seems to be going in the right direction under your leadership. So my hat's off to you in that regard. What's scary, though, with this pandemic, things could go in reverse quickly. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, well, so if this levy doesn't pass for us, we're going to be right back where I started 10 years ago. We're going to make cuts that are as deep as the ones I inherited, and that will undo the progress we've made. The pandemic is already hard on students who are trying to learn remotely and teachers who are trying to teach remotely, and we know that there's going to be a learning regression for all of the time kids haven't been in school. But we can make that up over time as long as we continue to support our schools. What would really devastate us long term is killing our schools by failing issue 68.
Eric, where are we now in the Cleveland schools? Is it all remote learning? And do you anticipate kids going to class here? I guess you have to watch what's going on with COVID-19. What's the story right now?
Yes, we're fully remote learning for the first quarter, which runs through November 6th. I actually am planning an announcement to our community on tomorrow about what we would likely do for the rest of this semester. I would tell you, though, that our community is 86% minority, and we know that COVID-19 has inflicted the minority community three to four times harder than the white community. My families are also essential workers. They're the people that are cleaning buildings, that are serving food, that are working frontline in healthcare systems. That puts them at risk. And then also, you know, the disparate healthcare that my families have had means they're also higher risk. So I've been very cautious about reopening our schools for our students, for our families, and for our staff members because of the high risk that our community faces.
As far as those that are working in the schools, keeping them safe and clean, how's that going? How do you feel comfortable with what's being done right now?
Yes, I feel good about the people who are already back to work. We've been very, very careful following strict health guidelines. We had limited COVID-19 cases, and we have been quick to have people self-isolate or quarantine if ordered by the health department and to do deep cleanings of those facilities. But that's easy to do when there's not kids in the building. As soon as you start bringing 37,000 children into the building, you have very different experiences, and that's why we're being so cautious.
I gotcha. One more question here, Mr. Gordon. I understand you have a pretty good relationship with the Cleveland Teachers Union. Can you give us any details on that? Is any contract negotiations coming up? Where do we stand with all that?
Well, our contracts for 9 labor unions will all be up here in December, and we will need to begin renegotiating them. I will say the teachers union has been a tremendous partner as we figured out COVID-19. You haven't seen the kind of squabbling that we've seen in many other cities and in suburbs around us. That in Cleveland, we've been working things out. And I would say all 9 of our labor unions have really stepped up. We made a commitment when COVID-19 happened to keep our workforce intact during the pandemic. And what we asked for in exchange was collaboration and partnership and flexibility. And that's exactly what we've gotten.
Very good. Well, we'll leave it on that note. Very positive note there. Mr. Gordon, thank you so much for joining us. And keep the faith, all right? Keep moving forward, all right?
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Eric Gordon, CEO of the Cleveland Metropolitan School District. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Tomorrow, the latest from the American Legion, the Alliance for Retired Americans, and Doreen Cannon of Plumbers Local 5 on Women in the Trades. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.